from Sapporo, Japan. This is the Debita.org podcast for March 1st, 2010. Thank you all for listening. Let's do a couple more of my old articles. First up, here's one of my community page Just Because columns which came out on Tuesday, November 4th, 2008. It is an essay on truth octane. Truth octane? Well, I'll explain in just a second. Here's the title. Truth, a delicate matter of give and take. Every activist and essayist must deal with a singular phenomenon when addressing the public, just how truthful one should be. I'm not talking about a choice between lying or truthing. I'm talking about just how much truth one should inject into the message, because, sadly, there's only so much truth a reader can take all at once. I call it a matter of truth octane. Too much truth, and your audience switches off, becoming reflexive rather than reflective. Too little, and you get platitudinous, warm, fuzzy clouds of fog, and no conclusions drawn. Consider some activism with a high truth octane, like Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, irrefutably linking the George W. Bush administration to oil interests and demonstrating a profit motive behind the Iraq War. Or Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, conclusively arguing that global warming is man-made and damaging. Or Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Or Uncle Tom's Cabin. Or even war photojournalism showing suffering, carnage, and death, bringing the awful truth into our living rooms. All are definitive attempts to bring obscured information to light. But again, as the nuance of the awful truth implies, too high a truth octane and people reject it, as in Bush got reelected and Al Gore had been spinning his wheels until recently, etc. It's not just because geopolitics, the environment, and war are complicated topics. It works like this. When advocates come on too strong with their claims, some people naturally express a healthy doubt. After all, readers haven't thought through on everything yet to the point where they can agree completely. However, opponents capitalize on that doubt, say, the subject is controversial, the presenter is partisan, or the viewpoint is not fair or balanced, and dilute down the octane. The easiest example to illustrate this with is photojournalism. Shocking images of death and destruction have a very high truth octane. So high, the Vietnam War demonstrated, that they can change minds about an entire war. So, even though people intrinsically know that war involves killing and mutilation, it gets censored. People just don't want to see it, especially if their government is in any way implicated. It would mean people confronting their own paradigms, realizing their support for the war may have been a mistake. So, we acquiesce in the censorship to escape those qualms. Okay, let's consider a less extreme example. Whenever I point out issues of racial discrimination to the media in Japan, even the sharpest reporter dulls his analytical scalpel. Well, of course, we know the issue is one of race, but our editor and readership might not, so we'll have to render it as discrimination by nationality or appearance, or gaiken. Or worse yet, portray it as a cultural misunderstanding, which means it is not even discrimination anymore. Again, we don't want to challenge the common paradigm. Racial discrimination happens in other countries, not Japan. It's too much to take. So, how does an activist deal with a high truth octane? One way is to dilute it yourself by offering caveats and disclaimers, such as, you know, discrimination is everywhere, Japan is not unique, or, well, I'm not bashing Japan or anything. That is, if you don't mind wasting column space on platitudes and debasing your own argument. Another way is to use satire. Show insight through various contrasts, ironies, metaphors, and parables. Consider examples such as Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, or some of the best episodes of South Park, or The Daily Show, or even the recent parodies of American political figures on Saturday Night Live. Comedy allows the truth octane to enter the psyche unadulterated, aided by the spoonful of sugar that is laughter. Alas, in Japan, political satire is in relatively short supply, especially on broadcast media. This is, after all, a country where sarcasm and irony are rarely seen as forms of humor. That means one less tool for activists to employ. You have to be entertaining while biting, which is a rare skill. So what can be done? Raise truth octane in small doses, and bring people along slowly. History indicates that the most foresighted people, from revolutionary scientists to activists you find on the faces of coins, persisted for years with their assertions and were subject, of course, to skepticism, rebuke, even the threat of violence for challenging the status quo. In the end, many prevailed, as they weaned increasing numbers of people onto a stronger truth octane. Finally, there was a tipping point, and then a society-wide paradigm shift. Consider this. Old ideas that were once taken for granted, such as slavery, lack of universal suffrage, and anti-miscegenation laws, were relegated to the dustbin of history. And that's how it starts. By speaking truth to power and to the public. How much truth you speak is completely a matter of timing. But those who can master their truth octane effectively can change the world. Right, and for my next column, this is from the Japan Times, Tuesday, December 2nd, 2008. It was my last column of the year, and it came out just after the Obama election. And my column reads, Hailing the Tail End of Bush. Regarding Barack Obama's election as U.S. President, I welcome the groundswell of hope. I mean, it's about time. The past 8 years have been, well, awkward for Americans overseas. The Bush 2 administration undermined America's image abroad. The Pew Global Attitudes Project, which surveys views of the U.S. from around the world, reported in 2007 that, and I quote, anti-Americanism is worldwide. This is not just a rift with our European allies or hatred of America in the Middle East. It is a global slide, end quote. Well, there's plenty to be ashamed of. Read a short list. Election oddities culminating in the year 2000 Supreme Court coup d'etat, opting out of the Kyoto Protocol and the International Criminal Court, the Orwellian Department of Homeland Security, or preemptive war as a superpower prerogative, circumventing the United Nations with a quote-unquote coalition of the willing, lack of policy oversight in a one-party Congress, a vice president with a bunker mentality, and extreme notions of executive privilege? Wars in two countries grounded on lies about weapons of mass destruction? Unwarranted wiretapping? Guantanamo? Abu Ghraib? Signing statements? Rendition? Torture memos and waterboarding? Forthcoming presidential pardons for connected felons? Need I go on? Even Bush's own party had to make change a platform plank in its campaigns ahead of the November polls. America's actions affect Japan profoundly because of the closeness of our relationship. America gave us General Douglas MacArthur, a constitution, a democracy, a post-war era without forced restitution, a market for a reconstruction, and a collective security agreement. We gave America a Pacific bulwark against communism and a market for their military. We're in a tango, with America taking the lead. Well, little of this was seen as a bad thing. When I first got here 20 years ago, many Japanese saw America as the society with freedoms and opportunities we lack here, or the country we'd most like to emulate. We had the Ron-Yasu, as in Reagan-Nakasone, relationship, compulsory education in American English, More people watching Hollywood films than domestic movies. Top Gun on TV more than once a year. You get the idea. The word most associated with America was akogare, akin to adoration. America was a template. Nowadays, it's more complicated. Although security and business relationships are largely intact, we are looking more towards a future with China, as everyone, while Big Brother America seems more of a bully. The U.S. demands we refuel ships for free in the Indian Ocean, and that we do something about Article 9 interfering with Japan's contribution to the War on Terror. Tangoing with America even raises fears of terrorist blowback. In terms of human rights, the American template cuts the wrong way. For example, last year, Japan reinstated fingerprinting for most foreign residents based upon the U.S. visit program. We even bought American fingerprinting machines. Officialdom's most common excuse for depriving non-Japanese of rights? Well, anti-terrorism. So, we assist in America's wars and then use them to treat foreigners like potential criminals. Voila, America's doing it, so can we. America is hardly something activists can point to as a paragon of human rights anymore. Pass a law against discrimination by race or nationality in Japan? Why, America now denies habeas corpus to its foreigners. Or, respect criminal procedure and due process of law? Well, fooey on youy, America abuses people in their extra-legal prisons too. Refer to U.S. State Department reports on Japan's human rights record? That's rich, coming from a country whose soldiers aren't even accountable in international criminal court. The State Department itself doesn't even survey America's own human rights record. I mean, nowadays people talk about America less in terms of justice, more in terms of superpower realpolitik, especially after it dropped North Korea from the terrorism watch list. Fortunately, with Obama's election, American politics became a renewable resource, a fount of change. Obama is even inspiring opposition parties here to call for change in Japan's government. Well, maybe. And maybe America can become a template for good deeds again. That is, if Bush hasn't made the U.S. irredeemable, and if America can learn to say no to its own excessive powers. Obama has a hard act to follow, but if he succeeds, human rights activists in Japan will also enjoy the turn of the tide. And finally, let me read you one more Japan Times column. This came out on Tuesday, January 6th, 2009. It is my annual roundup of human rights progress in Japan. This is my Just Because column entitled, Japan Sees Progress in 2008. As we start 2009, let's recharge the batteries by reviewing last year's good news. Here is my list of top human rights advancements for Japan in 2008, in ascending order. Number 6, the Uhoden victory, which happened in December 21, 2007, but close enough. The plaintiff is a Chinese-born professor at Japan Women's University who sued for damages on behalf of his Japanese grade school-age daughter. Abused by classmates for her Chinese roots, she suffered at school and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Professor Wu took the parents of the bullies to court and won. Why this matters. In an era when elementary schools are seeing the byproduct of Japan's explosion in international marriages, this ruling sets a positive precedent both for insensitive local boards of education and parents who want to protect their kids. Number 5. Strawberry Fields Forever. This happened February 11, 2008. 15 Chinese trainees sued Strawberry Farms in Tochigi Prefecture for unpaid wages, unfair dismissal, and attempted repatriation by force. Thanks to Zentoitsu Workers' Union, they were awarded 2 million yen each in back pay and overtime, a formal apology, and reinstatement in their jobs. Why this matters? This is another good precedent, treating non-Japanese laborers, who as trainees aren't covered by labor laws, the same as Japanese workers. It is also the subject of the German documentary Sour Strawberries. Number 4. The Parental Abduction Issue. It's one of Japan's worst-kept secrets, but not for much longer. Japan's laws governing access for both parents to children after divorce are weak to non-existent. Consequently, in the case of international breakups, one parent, usually the foreigner, loses his or her kids. As this newspaper has reported, even overseas court decisions awarding custody to the non-Japanese parent are ignored by Japanese courts. All the Japanese parent has to do is abduct their child to Japan and they're scot-free. Fortunately, international media this year, America's ABC News, the UK's Guardian, and Australia's Sydney Morning Herald, have joined Canada's media and government in exposing this situation. Why this matters? Our government has finally acknowledged this is a problem for domestic marriages, too, and made overtures to sign the Hague Convention on Child Abduction, for what that's worth, by 2010. More in the upcoming documentary From the Shadows, and you can find information on that at www.fromtheshadowsmovie.com. Number 3. Non-Japanese get 12,000 yen. This was December 20th, 2008. The Teigaku Kyufukin first started out as a clear bribe to voters to Yoroshiku, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. Then complaints were raised about the other taxpayers who aren't citizens. So permanent residents and non-Japanese married to Japanese became eligible. And finally, just before Christmas, all registered non-Japanese were included. Why this matters? Even if this stimulus is ineffective, it's a wall smasher. Japan's public policy is usually worded as applying to kokumin, or citizens only. It's the first time a government cash-back program, as in a 1999 coupon scheme, excluded all non-Japanese except for permanent residents, has included all non-citizen taxpayers and recognized their importance to the Japanese economy. Number 2. Nationality Law Revision. If a Japanese father impregnated a non-Japanese out of wedlock, the father had to recognize paternity before birth or the child would not get Japanese nationality. The Supreme Court ruled this unconstitutional on June 4, 2008, noting how lack of citizenship causes, quote, discriminatory treatment, unquote. Why this matters? Tens of thousands of international children have lost their legal right to Japanese citizenship, even, depending on their mother's nationality, become stateless, just because a man was too shy to own up to his seed or didn't acknowledge paternity in time. This ruling led to a change in the laws last December 2008. And number 1, the most important human rights progress of 2008, the Ainu declared an indigenous people. Why this matters? Because it not only affects the Ainu. The June 6, 2008 judgment finally shows how wrong the official pronouncements that Japan is a monocultural, monoethnic society have been. It also voids knock-on arguments that enforce ideological conformity for the insiders and exclusion for the foreigners. On September 28th, it even became a political issue, forcing the unprecedented resignation of Tourism Minister Nariaki Nakayama from the cabinet for mouthing off about ethnic homogeneity of Japan, well, among other things, too. And even Blue Blood Prime Minister Taro Aso had better think twice before contradicting the Diet's consensus on this issue. Things to watch in 2009. Let's see how good my crystal balling was. A. The possible abolition of gaijin cards. B. The registration of non-Japanese residents with their Japanese families. And C. Dual nationality. Well, A, as you know, and B, will be happening with some reservations in 2010. dual nationality? Ha, not even close. Okay, and that was the end of that column. I've been on the road for the past couple of weeks. I'll probably be on the road for a little while again in March. But before I go, let me leave you with another Duran Duran song. I think this one right here is pretty appropriate if we're talking about the Bush era. This is from their Big Thing album in 1988, and it is a song called Do You Believe in Shame? Right, and that will end the March 1st, 2010 Debuta.org podcast, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you later on in April. Take care. Bye-bye.